We are in a series that I started at the beginning of the summer called Jesus in the Old Testament. And so what we've been doing is we've been jumping all the way to the beginning of the Bible and seeing where Jesus fits thousands of years ago before he even showed up in person on the scene. Jesus said that the Old Testament was about him. And so we've been looking at stories in the Old Testament that reflect Jesus. Last week we dove into the story of the Exodus. We got in just at the beginning. And if you don't know the story of the Exodus, it's about the nation of Israel being stuck in slavery in Egypt, them calling out to God and say, God, would you free us? Would you help us? Would you save us? God picking a very specific person named Moses, plucking him out and saying, I'm choosing you to go and be my representative because I want to set the people of Israel free out of slavery into freedom. And it's interesting, looking back at that story before we continue, what strikes me about the story is that it's very obvious that God doesn't need Moses. He doesn't need Moses. When you see the story of the Exodus, God is very, very capable on his own to set the people of Israel free out of slavery. But one of the things that you notice when you read through the Bible is that God chooses to use people. He doesn't need people, but he wants to work with us. He wants to have a relationship with us. He wants to accomplish his purposes with us. And so we get to partner with him. In the story of Moses, he's really, really struggling in many ways in self-confidence. And as God is speaking to Moses, Moses says to God, who am I? Who am I? He's basically saying, why are you choosing me? There's a lot of better people you could choose. Who am I? And God's response to Moses very, very quickly is, I will be with you. God's response to Moses isn't, you're a good guy, I believe in you, you have the gifts and the talents that's required, that's why I chose you, you grew up in the right household, you have the right background. I mean, God doesn't say any of those things. He actually just says to Moses, I will be with you. And what God is saying in not so many words to Moses is that, Moses, I didn't choose you for all those things. You are going to be successful not because of all those things you think you need. You're going to be successful because I am with you. And that applies, even though that was said to Moses thousands of years ago, that applies to us today. I just want to encourage you with that again. Is that I believe that God is calling many of us here in this room, if you're watching on the internet, whatever, God is calling us to something that oftentimes we feel that we're not prepared for. God is going to ask us to do things that we're uncomfortable with. God is going to call us out of our comfort zone, and it's really easy for us to be like Moses. I relate to Moses, where we say to God, who am I? And God's response to you, I believe, would be the same response that he had to Moses when he says, I'm going to be with you. And that's the difference maker. The difference maker in this story is the presence of God. And so God gives Moses all these tools. I'm not going to go over those tools. In reality, this morning, I'm like going to be touching just on very specific points out of this story because I'm going to be covering Exodus chapter 4 all the way to Exodus chapter 12. I encourage you when you go home to read that. It's way more detailed, and I can't give you all the details. I'm going to be just hitting the finer points of this. But he gives Moses some tools. He says, I want you to go to the leaders of Israel. I want you to present yourselves to them. And then after that, I want you to go to Pharaoh. I'm going to give you the words to say, and I want you to present to him the fact that he's supposed to let this nation of slaves free. Exodus chapter 5, verses 1 to 2 says this, after this presentation to Israel's leaders, Moses and Aaron went and spoke to Pharaoh. They told him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so they may hold a festival in my honor in the wilderness." "Is that so?" retorted Pharaoh. "And who is the Lord? Why should I listen to him and let Israel go? I don't know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." He's responding exactly the way I would expect him to respond. The nation of Egypt and Pharaoh had all sorts of gods and deities. They had a god for everything. In fact, as we start touching on the plagues, we could go in detail about this, but they had gods for everything. The god for the Nile River, the god for the sun, the god for their crops. We could talk about the gods of Egypt all day long. And Moses shows up and he says, "Yes, and there's this one god. He's the god of this nation of slaves. And he's telling you to let them go." And Moses, growing up in the culture and the place in history that he's at, is going, "Well, who is this? I don't even know who he is. Who is he? Who is he that I should listen to him?" Now, Pharaoh was the most powerful king of the known world at that time. And in fact, in ancient Israel, ancient Egypt, they looked at Pharaoh as a god. And so he's saying, "Who is this god of slaves that's telling me what to do?" In fact, when they looked at gods in the ancient world, in many ways, they kind of lumped them all together. And so there was kind of this sense where it was like, one god is similar to all the rest. And we can, this god of the Hebrews, this god of the Israelites, we can just lump him in with all the rest of our gods. Doesn't mean I'm going to listen to him, but we can lump him in with all the rest. I believe that Pharaoh's attitude is actually not that far from where we're at in modern day times. We use different words. We don't use the word gods so much, but we may use the word belief systems, religions, cultures. And when we, as a whole across the planet today in the 21st century, when we look at belief systems and religions and gods, we typically want to say that they all lead to the same thing. Maybe you heard of that, right? All roads lead to God, or all roads lead to heaven, or there's many ladders and they all kind of ascend to the same place. So whether I believe this or I believe that, or I believe in this God or that God, as long as my heart is right, as long as I have the right intentions, then it's all going to be okay. It's all going to work out. But when I read this story, I don't see that. I see this God named Yahweh showing up on the scene, and we're going to see very quickly that in a nation that is full of belief systems and full of gods and full of religion, this Yahweh shows up on the scene and he asserts himself. And he actually says, there's actually one God, and everything that you know and believe is under me. He's going to assert himself over the gods of the Egyptians. In this story, after Moses comes to him and basically says, "Let my people go," Pharaoh is actually really upset. He's ticked off. He's offended. And he's like, "If you think you're going to get away with that, look what's going to happen next." And he ends up piling on more work upon the Egyptians than they ever had before. They were slaves already. But now he piles on more work upon them. And Moses ends up coming back to his people, and his people end up like even under greater slavery and greater workload and greater stress and greater anxiety than they've ever had before. And God keeps on telling the people of Israel, "Trust me, I'm setting you free. I am doing something. Trust me. And in Exodus chapter 6, verse 9, it says this: So Moses told the people of Israel what the Lord had said, but they refused to listen anymore. They had become too discouraged by the brutality of their slavery. It's interesting when I read this. They are dealing with, I think, what every single one of us would deal with in their situation. In some ways, I think what we're dealing with even now today. They're being told salvation is coming, but in reality, all they're experiencing is greater workload, greater anxiety, greater pressure. And they're looking at the situation, they say, I don't see anything changing. I don't see anything changing. What is the situation that you're in? I look at this COVID situation, to be honest with you, I'm sitting here and we're singing the song Waymaker. Song Waymaker. And it's a song of promise about God making a way. And at the beginning of this COVID situation, I really felt deeply in my heart, God really speak to me saying, I have a plan in the middle of this. I want to do something special. And now we're months in. It's like the end of August, and we opened up services in the beginning of June, and we're at the end of August. We're coming into September. And to be honest, sometimes I'm really discouraged. Do you feel discouraged? I feel discouraged at times, if I'm going to be 100% honest. I look at it, and I go, God, what is happening? To be honest, I feel like I look at the spiritual climate of where we're at least here in Kamloops, and it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. The church looks like it's hurting. I go, are people growing in their faith? Are people going further in their faith? And I look at this story, and it's like, and I sing that song, Waymaker, and it's like the Spirit of God is saying, yes, I've spoken, I'm going to do something, can you trust me? Can you believe in me even when the days seem darkest and darker than ever before? That I'm going to set you free. I'm going to set you free from this COVID. I'm going to set you free from this situation that you're in. Whatever you're dealing with, God hasn't stopped listening and he hasn't stopped working. And I think for these Egyptians at this moment in time, it felt probably like forever. From the moment that God spoke and said, I'm going to set you free, to the moment it actually happened, it doesn't give us months, it doesn't give us days. We don't know. It could have been a good period of time. It probably felt like forever. But sometimes it gets worse before it gets better. You ever experienced that? Our lives are affected by other people's decisions. Our lives are affected by other people's sin. I think it was really easy for the people of Israel to almost look at God and be angry and frustrated. And he said, you promised me something. What is happening? Why is this happening to us? Why are we experiencing this? But the reality is, it wasn't God. It was the sin of Pharaoh. One man's sin affected the rest. One man's stubbornness against God affected the rest. Do you know that your life doesn't just affect you, it affects other people? When you look towards God in your stubbornness and you decide to live specific ways and you say, I'm going to do my own thing, but you say to yourself, it just affects me, you end up lying to yourself. Our lives affect other people, and Pharaoh's life affected an entire nation. In fact, it affected two nations, Egypt and Israel. Because of Pharaoh's disobedience, God had to bring the pain. This is a really, really hard story to understand at times, but Pharaoh's disobedience brought the pain. And we see it in the story of these 10 plagues. Sometimes our disobedience brings pain as well. It's probably not going to look like 10 plagues. Thank God. But sometimes our obedience brings pain as well. And in this situation, it was the disobedience of Pharaoh that brought these 10 plagues. Now, I think that when you read through this story, God was really hoping that Pharaoh's heart would change and let his people go. And he gave Pharaoh every single opportunity for that to happen, and he continued to resist. And he brought one plague after another. And after every single plague that he brought on the nation of Egypt, Moses would go back and be like, okay, are you ready now? Are you ready to obey? Are you ready to let the people of Israel go? And Pharaoh kept on playing with the nation of Israel and kept on trying to negotiate with God. If you read through the story, he's negotiating with God. Let me tell you, God doesn't negotiate. He won't negotiate with you. You can do your own thing, and it might bring pain, but God doesn't negotiate. No, he says, this is the what I'm doing. This is the way it's happening. Get on board. Because if you don't get on board, this is happening. He brings 10 plagues. You know, in the Bible, numbers represent a lot, and 10 in the Bible represents fullness of quantity. Fullness of quantity. So in reality, it's like these 10 plagues, it's almost like the fullness of pain that God is bringing upon the nation of Egypt. Later on, when God set Israel free, Moses up on Mount Sinai, and he receives how many commandments? 10 commandments. Represent like the fullness of the law that God wants to give the nation of Israel. Did you know that in these plagues, it was because of one man's sin and everybody suffered with it, with Pharaoh? There was a lot of innocent people in the nation of Egypt that suffered along with Pharaoh. In fact, some of these plagues, it doesn't say that the plagues separated from the Egyptians and the Israelites. Some of these plagues actually show that it probably hit the Israelites as well. That the innocent suffered with the guilty. I was going to go over like these 10 plagues with you a little bit more in detail, but I just don't have time today. But it's interesting that when you look at these 10 plagues, they're plagues that are hit against the very things that are most valuable to Pharaoh and the nation of Egypt. In fact, most of these plagues would be against the gods of Egypt. Like the first plague, the plague of blood, God turns the Nile into blood. The Nile was the lifeblood of the nation of Egypt. Everything flowed out of the Nile. Their crops, and I mean, Egypt's basically in the middle of a desert, and things come to life because of the Nile River, and so they worshipped it, and there was a lot of gods from Khnum to Hapi to Osiris that these gods are focused on the Nile, and this very thing that they worship, and they have all these gods that look over over the Nile and make sure that the Nile is healthy. The very first plague that God sends against the nation of Egypt is turning the very thing that they worship, and he poisons it. He turns it into blood. And God's making a very specific statement in this plague, but in all the plagues. He says, you think that these Egyptian gods control this. You think these Egyptian gods control the Nile, and they control your fertility, and they control your food, and they control your water, and they control everything. But I want you to know that there is a God over everything, and I'm the one that controls this. It's not Osiris, it's not Hapi, it's not Khnum, but it's me. And so first there's this river turning to blood, and then there's frogs, and then there's gnats or lice. Ugh. When they translate the Hebrew word, it can translate as a gnat or a lice. A gnat is like a tiny little biting fly, like a mosquito, or it's lice. I'm going like, I don't know which one's worse. Probably lice. Hey, have you read it? There's flies, and then there's And then there's the death of the livestock. Then they get boils. You ever seen a boil or had a boil? Sometimes, like, they're so big, they can get, like, that big, and they're pussy, and they're sore. Yeah, I could have thrown a picture up there of a boil, but I wouldn't want to do that to you guys. And then there's hail that comes and destroys the crops. And then there's these locusts that come through and eat whatever is left of what the hail destroyed. And then there's the darkness over the land. You've probably heard of the Egyptian god Ra, R-A. Ra was thought to be the sun god. And in some ways they saw Ra as the king of the gods, the father of creation. And in the ninth plague, just before the last one, I mean, you see it in the first with the Nile and blood, and then the ninth, just before the tenth, it's like he's striking very much at the heart of their belief of the god Ra, where darkness covers the land. And God's like, you think Ra controls this? You think Ra is the one that created this world and gave life and that he's the king of the gods? No, it's me. It's Yahweh. You know these slaves that you look down upon? Yeah, it's their God. I am the one. I am the one that controls all this. And you'd think after these nine plagues that Pharaoh would be like, yeah, I give up. But he doesn't. He doesn't. And so the tenth plague comes against the nation of Egypt. And I think this is the very last plague. God holds it to the very last because this is the one he doesn't want to do. And God pronounces death against the firstborn of every single Egyptian family, firstborn male child, and against every firstborn male animal. I mean, even the animals are suffering in this. Why does God choose that? Why does he choose the firstborn male child of all the families of the nation of Egypt? Well, it's interesting. If you looked more towards the beginning of Exodus, God proclaims that, you know, he's relating to the culture of that time and he's relating to the Egyptians at that time, and he says, Israel is my firstborn child. Israel is my firstborn child, and you are holding my firstborn child in slavery. You need to let my firstborn child go. And earlier in the story, what we read last week is Pharaoh takes actually every single male baby, not the firstborn. But Pharaoh takes every single male baby and he throws them into the Nile River to drown and die. And God gives Pharaoh every single opportunity to repent. Finally, the nail comes down. He says, you've taken my firstborn child and you've thrown him as slavery, and then you've taken their children and every single male child and you've killed them. If this is what it takes, Pharaoh, I'm now taking your firstborn male child. I'm now taking yours. So how does God distinguish between the Egyptians and the Israelites? Freedom is coming, and it's time to prepare the nation of Israel to set them free. And so that night, he gives instructions to Moses, and he says, every single family is supposed to take a lamb or a goat, and you're to slaughter it, and you're to cook it, and you're going to take the blood of that, and you're going to smear it on the doorpost of your house. And that is how I'm going to know that you are separate from them. When we hear this story in the 21st century, this idea of sacrifice and animal slaughter and blood and all of that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us. But in ancient Near Eastern culture, this idea of sacrifice, they fully understood it. They fully understood it. In fact, in Exodus chapter 12, verse 5, it says this: the animal you select must be a one-year-old male, either a sheep or a goat, with no defects. It's interesting. So they're supposed to take a male sheep or a male goat, and it's supposed to be without defects. Why is that? This idea of no defect really represents this idea of like taking something that is without fault and standing in the place of someone else. These animals, this idea of no defect is this idea of like without fault, without sin. Did that animal deserve to die? No. But it stands in the place of someone else. Exodus chapter 12, verse 8 says this: that same night, they must roast the meat over a fire and eat it along with bitter salad greens and bread made without yeast. It's fascinating. So this lamb represents something dying in our place so that we can live. Death is going to pass over the houses of these Israelites. Death is coming. But this lamb is dying in their place so they can live. And then they're supposed to have these bitter salad greens. I think God must have meant kale. I think if we translate this, God's saying, I want you to have a kale salad. That sounds like a plague to you? But this bitter salad greens represents slavery to them. It's to remind them of the bitterness of slavery. And they're supposed to have bread made without yeast. Who here has ever made bread before with yeast? It takes a while, doesn't it? You know, you got to put the yeast in warm water, and you got to give it time, then you got to add it to the flour, and you mix it all together and knead it, and then you got to let it sit for X number of hours so that it can rise, and then you come back, and then you pound it down again, and then you got to let it rise again. There's this whole process of dealing with yeast. And God's like, no, 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 you don't have any time to actually make bread with yeast. This is happening really, really quick. And I want you to be ready. In fact, he gives them instructions that I want you to have a staff in your hand. I want you to have your sandals on. I want you to have, you know, make sure you're dressed to travel. Because this is going to be really, really quick. And you don't have time to make bread with yeast. Forget the yeast. Just throw the bread in the oven. It's going to represent how quickly you need to be ready to go. Do you know that when God is ready to do something, he wants us to be ready too? It reminds me of the story of the virgins that Jesus talks about. You know, those is it 10 virgins that Jesus talks about in the New Testament? It's a parable and how they have their lamps lit. And it's this idea that the bridegroom is going to come at any moment and the bride needs to be ready for the bridegroom coming. And some of those women aren't ready and some of them are ready. And it's this parable of being ready where Jesus is constantly telling us, be ready. I'm coming at any time. Don't get too relaxed. And Jesus is still saying that to us today. Don't get too lax. I'm going to come at any time. Be prepared. Be spiritually prepared. Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, it says that this: on that night I will pass through the land of Egypt and strike down every firstborn son and firstborn male animal in the land of Egypt. I will execute judgment against all the gods of Egypt, for I am the Lord. I'm going to pause there. Where is the judgment coming against? It's interesting. You'd think that it would be right saying the judgment is coming against Pharaoh, against the nation of Egypt. Actually, what God is doing is says the judgment is against the gods of Egypt. There's a spiritual power that's controlling this nation. There's a spiritual power that is ungodly that these people are worshiping, and my judgment is coming against the gods of Egypt. But the blood on your doorposts will serve as a sign, marking the houses where you are staying. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. This plague of death will not touch you when I strike the land of Egypt. I'm going to pass over you. Put that blood on the doorposts of your house because I'm going to pass over you. John chapter 1, verse 29, there's John the Baptist, and he's come and he's preaching, he's baptized, and he's saying a Messiah is coming. I'm here to prepare the way for the Messiah. And he sees Jesus in the distance walking towards him, and he says, it says in verse 29, the next day John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. I don't know if John fully understood what he was saying, but he was so right, spirit-led in what he's saying. He's saying, look at this man. Look at Jesus. He's not just a man, but he is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This has never been said up until Jesus. It would have been shocking. What are you saying, John? What do you mean by that? Here is the Lamb of God, Jesus. Everything that we just read is represented in Jesus. Jesus is a spotless lamb without defect, who had to give his life. Did he deserve to die? No. But he gave his life willingly. And he dies on our behalf so that we don't die. Jesus is represented in that lamb. Listen to this. Exodus chapter 12, verse 4, he says, each Passover lamb must be eaten in one house. Do not carry any of its meat outside and do not break any of its bones. I mean, I can't go over all of it, but like, this is one thing that's so interesting. They're not supposed to break the bones of the Passover lamb. Why? I don't know. But Jesus is on the cross, his blood being spilled. In some ways, the cross is like that doorpost. And Jesus' blood is being spilled. And typically, when people were crucified in the first century, it would be a very long and arduous death. And so sometimes the soldiers would come along and they'd break the legs of the people, and it would speed up the death of the people being crucified. They come to Jesus and they realize that he's actually already dead, and so they don't break his legs. Not one of his bones was broken, just like that passage foreshadowed in Exodus chapter 12, verse 46. Not one of Jesus' bones was broken. The perfect Passover lamb for us. This is a story. It's interesting, these words redemption and salvation are the two main words that pop up within this story. And it runs, that idea of redemption, salvation is a continual emphasis throughout the rest of the Bible and culminates in Jesus Christ. This idea of redemption is purchasing back something, paying off a debt. God looked at the people of Israel and he was purchasing back something that was taken from him. He was redeeming slaves out of slavery. Jesus died on the cross for us because we were in slavery to sin. Every single one of us. Jesus died to set us free. And that is the good news. Jesus is the one who comes to redeem us. And there's this word that salvation pops up as well in the story of Exodus. This idea of deliverance and rescue and liberation. That's what Jesus did. He came to rescue us. He came to liberate us. He came to deliver us. I'm going to invite the worship team forward. Before we go into communion, would there be any questions that you guys want to throw out? Always like to leave an opportunity. If you have a question, you're like, what about this? What about that? When they had that first Passover, it was never meant to be a one-off. But God told the people of Israel that they were actually going to do that every year. This idea of Passover was going to be something that they were going to do every single year so that they could remember. And once they were out of Egypt and they established their own homes in the land of Canaan, you can imagine if they did this every year, they would be putting blood on the doorposts of their home. And that would be a reminder to them every single day. Can you imagine walking through the entrance and the exit of your home every single day, and what you would see is you'd see that blood smeared, reminding you every single day where you came from and what God did for you. Where you came from and what God did for you. And so Passover changed. You know, cultures change, and they continued to celebrate Passover over the years. By the time Jesus shows up on the scene, they're still celebrating Passover. But you can imagine over thousands of years, traditions develop. And the tradition had developed by the time of Jesus. And then Jesus shows up on the scene, and then he changes it again. And he says, this Passover is actually all about me, and it's about what I'm going to do for you. Passover isn't just about remembering, but it's about believing and trusting. Communion that we do in celebration of Passover and remembering what Christ did isn't just about remembering, but it's about trusting and believing. What I mean by that is that this idea of Passover, when God gave them those instructions, they had to go and do it. They had to believe. They had to take the lamb. They needed to kill the lamb. They needed to take the blood, and they needed to spread it over the doorposts of their house. They needed to put on their sandals. They needed to make bread. They needed to prepare. And all of that took believing and trusting, and they had to apply it to themselves. They had to apply it to their own home. Couldn't have Moses done this for the entire nation of Israel? Couldn't they have all just gathered together in one big clump and Moses did it for the rest of them? No, he said every single home, you need to do it yourself. You needed to believe yourself. You need to trust yourself. You needed to apply it yourself to your own home. Jesus shows up on the scene and he says, my salvation is for you. But are you going to believe? Are you going to trust? Are you going to apply it to yourself? Have you taken what Jesus has done and applied it to your life? Trusting and believing what Jesus has done for you. Not just something to remember, not just a historical fact to remember, but something for you. Where it's for you, where Jesus died for you.